This is Bill McClure for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Take My Arm.
This is Richard Dunnigan. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is prepared with the assistance of print and visually impaired volunteers.
And this is Bob Martin. And I have the feeling that something really interesting is going to happen today.
And I know just what it is.
You do?
So do I. And you are so right when you said that it was going to be something really interesting.
I am?
We want to congratulate you on your knowing it.
That's interesting. What am I expecting?
Not what, but whom.
Richard and I met someone, and he agreed to come and talk with us.
Who is it?
He has a law degree from UNC Chapel Hill.
He has a master's degree in public policy from Duke.
He was a practicing attorney in Durham County.
He was selected as Lawyer of the Year in 1985 for his work with TROSA, a drug rehabilitation program.
He was appointed to the bench by Governor James Hunt, Jr. in 1996.
And he served as a district court judge until 2008.
And he's going to be here?
Yes, he is.
Well, I expected something like this. It's just a knack I have. But I thought most of our guests had some kind of visual impairment.
And so does the judge. His name is Craig Brown, and he was a district court judge in Durham County for 12 years, and he is totally blind.
And he was still an attorney and a judge?
As an attorney, he had some vision, but as a judge, he was blind.
How was he able to do that?
That's what he's coming here to tell us. And remember, Bob, just because a man hasn't any eyes doesn't mean he doesn't have brains.
Dr. Jacob Bulletin, I remember. And he's totally blind?
That's right.
And he's going to be here today?
Yes, he is.
And you're going to be here too, Bill? I mean, at the same time?
Is there something wrong with that?
Oh, no. It's just that means there's going to be two of you?
Does being in the same room with two blind people make you uncomfortable?
Well, no. I was just thinking, what would happen if we happen to have to go somewhere? I mean, when I'm with you, Bill, you take my arm. But what happens if there are two people who need to take an arm?
You have two arms, don't you?
Well, yes.
Bob, you just might be surprised at how creative blind people can be when it comes to getting around.
After all, he was able to get to the judge's bench by himself for 12 years.
Kind of gives a new meaning to the phrase blind justice, doesn't it?
Would you believe he wrote an autobiographical book with exactly that title?
I think I'd like to meet him.
Good idea.
I'm here talking today with Craig Brown. Craig, why don't you just start by telling me a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and a little bit about your personal life.
I was born in Iowa City, Iowa. My father was employed by the Veterans Administration, so we traveled all over the eastern United States. Came through Durham the first time, and from 1966 to 1968, when my dad was assistant director of the VA hospital in Durham. From there, we went to Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where he was assistant director there. Then Dad got the break of his life. Richard Nixon had appointed an Iowan to head the VA, and he decided that an Iowan had to lead the Iowa City VA hospital, and my dad was the only one on the list. So he jumped over 256 more senior candidates. We went to the Woodrow Wilson School in Princeton, New Jersey, and from there we went back to Iowa City, Iowa, where I was born, where Dad became director of the VA hospital, then the youngest director ever in the VA system. Dad was a hard act to follow. When I graduated from Iowa City City High School in 1975, I was the sole Iowan who was accepted by the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. When I came through Durham as a child, in the fourth grade, I went over with my class to play the kazoo at Memorial Hall during the spring. And the campus at that time was just simply so beautiful that I always wanted to come back. And I was able to. I'm certainly grateful for that. At the University of North Carolina, in many ways, I blossomed. I was very active in terms of student government and ultimately was awarded a Chancellor's Award at the conclusion of my senior year. From there, I went to law school at the University of North Carolina. In addition to that, I obtained a master's degree in public policy from Duke University as well. After that, I went to work in Durham with the former Spears Law Firm downtown. Now, during my college years, the first indications of my chronic illness began to develop. I won't go into detail, except to say that the eye portion of that illness began in 1979. By 1981, I was half blind. I was in law school at the time. By 1984, I was permanently half blind. 11 years after that, they told me one or two, but it took 11, thank God. I lost my sight entirely. Was in law practice at the time that occurred. As I got into more and more criminal matters and began to try more and more serious cases, it became clear to me that there was a substantial need for additional substance abuse treatment services in Durham that were not available for the poor. When I tried the capital murder case of State versus Waters in 1992, he was a chronic alcoholic, 24 years old, drank 13 to 14 quarts of Old English Ale a day, was drunk when he murdered his victim. It became clear to me that I had to do something myself. It was no longer a question of going, oh, well, somebody else can take care of the problem. It became one of the things I simply had to do. And that led to my involvement with TROSA. TROSA is a long-term, two-year drug rehabilitation facility in Durham. It not only provides substance abuse treatment, but also job training, GED. You have to learn at least three job skills. In addition to the two-year program, there is also a year and a half of aftercare. It has been extremely successful as a program and as a model. Frankly, it should be adopted in other places in the state. But that certainly was not just me. The director, Kevin McDonald, and of course the residents and staff deserve a lot of the credit as well. As a result of that, though, in 1995, I was named the North Carolina Lawyer of the Year by the North Carolina Bar Association. And from that, ultimately I was named as a district court judge in Durham County September 30th of 1996. And thus began my judicial journey for the next 12 years or so. When I was on the bench, of course, being blind, it was very different from what a sighted judge would be able to do. In a way, I had to completely change the way law was practiced in my courtroom because I certainly could not see anything. And the lawyers simply had to learn that if the trier of fact, me, could not see what they were doing, that they had to explain it to me in extreme detail. And I had to be more active from the bench because if I didn't understand the particulars of a situation, it was up to me to ask questions about it, to make sure that I did, because I could only reach the best possible decision, the best judgment, if I had a full understanding of what in particular was going on in the case that was before me. So that process took a while in terms of getting the lawyers to work with me and understand how to do it in my particular courtroom.
Let's go back, and I want you to build the timeline a little bit about how you progressed from a law student when you started to lose your vision, and that moved on into becoming a practicing attorney with partial vision, and then eventually became a judge, and you were fully blind at that point.
Yes, sir.
Tell me how you moved through those. What are some of the obstacles that you felt like you faced because of losing your vision? And also, what are some of the ways that you learned to overcome that? Like you're telling me about how you had to teach the lawyers how to present their evidence to you once you became a judge. Sort of give us a little help in understanding using your handicap, not letting it stand in the way of you accomplishing the goal that you had set for yourself.
Right. Well, it was a step-by-step process. Going blind does a real psychological whammy upon anyone. It really strikes at self-confidence. It really knocks it down. It knocks you down for a while. So it was an evolving process over 20 years, but frankly, it's still not completed today, nor will it ever be. Because it's an ongoing process, not simply something where you make one decision and boom, it's done and you move on to the next thing. It affects you in every way, in terms of how you live, in terms of how you work, in terms of how you love, the whole nine yards. It's certainly well beyond the judicial field. It's much more personal than that. In terms of how I did it, I would say initially, in a way, I kind of ignored it because it was just so hurtful for me to think about, and so depressing for me to think about, that I just went on despite it. That's my stubborn side, in case you wondered. When I dig in, I'm going to fight, and fight long and hard. And all of your listeners should do that as they approach their own loss of vision whether it's partial or total, in terms of how they lead their lives. Never give up and never lie down, because that's not why you're here. So for me, it was a long journey. I went into rehabilitation for the first time in 1995. I went to the Lions World Center in Little Rock, Arkansas. I went that far away, frankly, because the rehab center at the Moorhead School is so close to Durham, where my practice was. And I knew myself well enough to know that I'd be on the phone every night with X, Y, and Z, this client, that client, this partner, that partner, about my legal cases. And that is not, frankly, a way to learn in terms of rehabilitation. So I had to get away. I frankly tried every technological treatment in terms of trying to restore my sight. Ultimately, because of the optic nerve atrophy on both my right and left side, you know, none of those devices could work. And then, of course, as is common, my first marriage failed. That was a very painful aspect of it, too. But as I said before, it's very common. 95% of all marriages where one partner becomes totally disabled fail. And that is not a statistic of which we should be proud, but it is reality. And you can understand why in many ways, because it totally changes the nature and scope and course of the relationship, the way that both parties work with each other, because one party becomes so much dependent upon the other party as a result of their loss of vision.
You mentioned first marriage, so does that mean that you are remarried?
Twice since.
Okay.
I'm on marriage number three.
You're on marriage number three.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those two, you are already blind by the time you met them?
No, I was not blind by the time I met my first wife. She was, of course, aware of the situation and aware of the fact that that would happen. But there's a difference between being aware of it and knowing it when it does.
And the second wife?
The second wife, I was completely blind. And after I dropped off the bench, she was gone in 7 months.
And then the third wife that you're now with?
I met her at a retirement center in Durham. I didn't expect to meet someone there. Frankly, I hadn't counted on children of residents to meet there. My cane was trapped in the long draperies as I was going to brunch, and she was coming up behind me, and she asked if she could help. And instead of saying no, because I could have done it myself, instead of saying no, I said yes, and here we are.
Well, that's great. I want to go back to a little bit about when you were in college. You had some vision loss starting at undergraduate level?
Started really by first semester of law school.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how that affected your studies and how you approached it as a student.
Well, it was very difficult. I was diagnosed in September of 1979, which was my first semester of law school. The eye symptoms really didn't start until about a year and a half later, but the course was defined. Frankly, I went not only to UNC, ophthalmological department there, but also the Duke Eye Center, as well as the Mayo Clinic, as well as Johns Hopkins. All of them had bad news. I was going to go blind, totally blind, within the next year or two. What the doctors at Duke and at UNC primarily determined was they would hit me with mass dosages of prednisone. Over the course of my life, I've taken 400,000 milligrams of prednisone.
Give us a perspective on that.
Well,
as somebody has prednisone for some other...
Sure.
What would they get? What would they take?
2 milligrams to 10.
Okay.
I was taking 100 a day.
Wow.
For 10 years, roughly. 100 a day, but they try to taper down. It wasn't quite that all the time. 400,000 milligrams is probably conservative. Fortunately, I had none of the behavioral impacts of being on prednisone. It can make you very hyper. It can make you very angry. Didn't have any of those. It did put a lot of weight on me. I went from being 180 pounds to 260. And that was probably the biggest impact. It also caused me to have acne into my 40s and that type of thing. But other than that, it would just make you think every day that you were sick. And it wasn't going to get any better. It was going to get worse. Ultimately, though, I decided that I was going to go forward with my legal studies, even though some questioned my appropriateness for doing that, given my situation. From 1981 to 1984, I had 19 hemorrhages in my left eye. I've had 3 steroid injections in my right eye. I've had both my right and left eyes developed cataracts as a result of all the prednisone. So I had the cataracts removed. I had 6 laser surgeries in the left eye. Frankly, if you could throw in the kitchen sink, that would about cover it.
Now, were you able to read textbooks?
I could, because my right eye, for whatever reason, held on for another 11 years. So I could read.
So you finished law school then, being able to read without them.
That is correct.
Okay. When did you start needing to use adaptive technology?
1990. And I would use the Zoom technology, a magnifying glass to read and that type of thing. And then, frankly, it became a situation where I would have my legal assistant read all correspondence and pleadings and things of that nature to me. And I, in turn, would use dictation to get all my various pleadings and letters and what have you out to clients or for cases and that type of thing.
Now, obviously, it didn't inhibit you from being a lawyer.
No.
Do you think it affected you in any way in terms of perception of your clients or...
Oh, there's no question.
Other attorneys?
There's no question, because it's not like I would wear it as a symbol. My clients couldn't understand, some of them, why I wouldn't look them in the eye. And then, of course, there are the myths about blind people. Oh, my goodness, there's so many.
Give us some of your favorites.
Well, let's see. The second week I was on the bench, one of the defendants was on the witness stand talking about her case, and she began screaming into the microphone. And she continued that way for about 30 seconds, and I told her, "Ma'am, you don't need to do that." And she kept screaming in the microphone. And I told her again, "You don't have to do that. I can hear." And she kept doing it. And I just looked over at her, and I said, "Ma'am, I may be blind, but as yet, I am not deaf." So there are many misconceptions about the blind out there. That's certainly just one of them. One of the others was that people would see me trailing a finger down the wall. From that, the rumor started that I was drunk. So you would be amazed at what people think. And it's simply not true. The blind are just like everybody else. They're just normal people who happen to be blind.
Well put.
Well, Bob, what do you think so far? Still worried about two of us being on the show at the same time?
I was misquoted and misunderstood when I misspoke.
That was interesting.
It sure was. Listening to Judge Brown's story gives a whole new meaning to the phrase blind justice.
And why is that, Bob?
It's like what you told me once. Sighted people tend to make judgments based on appearances. When you were once asked if someone was attractive, you said that it depended upon the way someone was, not on how they looked. And the same thing applies to justice.
That is a very good point. Equality before the law should be one of the easiest goals to attain. What is legal or illegal for everyone, not depending on who they are or what they look like.
That's why the symbol of the Statue of Justice wears a blindfold. One law for everybody.
The late Lenny Bruce once said that whenever he had to go into court, his attorney would tell him, "Wear a blue suit." So, the only conclusion was that if you looked into a courtroom and saw someone in a blue suit, you knew they were guilty.
Blind justice. Interesting concept, isn't it?
And it sure seems to apply to Judge Craig Brown. I want to hear some more of his story.
Now, tell me a little bit about how you moved from being an attorney to a judge. First of all, how does a lawyer get tapped as a possible judge candidate? Is it an elected position? Is it an appointment position? Well, and how did that work for you?
Well, for me, it can be either. For me, it was via an appointment. What that requires in North Carolina is for the lawyers in that judicial district to vote on the top 3 names, which are then submitted to the governor. Frankly, I was crushed in the bar vote, 242 for Ann McCowan, 152 for me, and 136 for Marcia Morey. But what everybody didn't know is that I'd been working on the upper level of influence, if you will, for quite a while. I've been active in the Democratic Party since 1984 and still continue to be to a degree. So I had David Price, who had taught me as a student at Duke. He was in my corner. Bob Morgan, the former U.S. Senator from Lillington, had helped me with the TROSA program. He was in my corner. And then I had Travis Porter, who was one of Jim Hunt's keys in Durham, supporting me as well because he had known me since I was a college student because his son, Greg Porter, and I were very close friends and were for years after that. So when it came to the second tier, I was in a stronger position. Frankly, as I look back on it now, it may also have been a result of the governor closing the deaf school in Greensboro and knowing that he needed to tap a disabled person for some kind of position to somewhat make up for that. One of the people that I talk with as part of my, what I would call the second step in a judicial appointment, which is trying to get the involvement of significant leaders within the state to exert influence upon the governor. One of the people I spoke with was Terry Sanford. I had met Terry Sanford years before. I'm sure he didn't remember me. And I decided to call him out of the blue. And when I did, to my surprise, he picked up the phone. And, you know, here I am on the phone with Terry Sanford asking if I can get an appointment to come see him. And by goodness, he takes me at 10 o'clock the next morning. So I walk into his office and I hand him my letter, and I'm standing in front of his desk, and there is this imposing man with white hair standing in front of me. I could see a little bit at that time. I could see that much, not much more. He's looking at my letter of introduction. He's looking at my resume, and he looks over at me, and he goes, "So, what's it like to be blind?" Now, I had expected that question, but I certainly didn't expect it as the first question. Oh, my goodness. I reeled. You know, I didn't know quite what to say. Was I going to do the intellectual thing? Was I going to do the me against the world thing? Was I going to do the survivor type thing? Ultimately, because I only had about 10 seconds to answer the question before I would look terribly at unease, and I didn't want to appear that way, I just was honest with him. And I still can't believe I said it. I go, "Well, it sucks." And he started laughing. And he just roared for about a minute. And then he asked me to sit down, and we talked about poverty and crime and race relations in Durham for the next hour. It was quite a fascinating conversation. I didn't know then that Terry Sanford talked with Jim Hunt every day. I do know that now. But I certainly think he was in my corner when it came down to the appointment, and that his support mattered. Now, the appointment had to be made by September 30th of 1996, or by statute, automatically the leading vote-getter became the judge. Now, Jim Hunt had never been known for not making appointments. I mean, if he had a chance to make an appointment, by golly, he made one. As the interview date approached, Hurricane Fran hit. That was September 6th of 1996. And it tore Durham to pieces, just as it did Raleigh and the Triangle area. Shut us down for a week. My mother, who had been ill, was in a rehabilitation center and was continuing to sink. My father had passed away in January of 1993 after a massive heart attack. And frankly, my mom was never the same after that. The two of them had been so close. But she passed away the night before I had my interview with Governor Hunt, and I called the next morning to try and postpone the appointment. Of course, Hurricane Fran had happened. He had until September 30th to make the appointment, and I was told no. The appointment had to go forward. So I went to the interview with Jim Hunt with no sleep on the eve of the death of my mother. And in fact, my mother died that night. My appointment was the next afternoon. And it was not my best performance. In fact, in one chapter of Blind Justice, my first book, I relate the entire conversation of Governor Hunt appointing me. And at one point he asked me, "Well, I was concerned about your toughness." And I reminded the governor that my mother had died the night before. And that sort of put that one to rest. But it was a very difficult time.
While the judge is visiting with us, we asked him to be a part of one of our Blind Justice stories. I think now would be a good time.
It's time again for the TRRS Radio Theater on the Air with Judge Craig Brown, Bill McClure, Richard Dunnigan, and Bob Martin with another episode of
Blind Justice.
The scene opens at a meeting of the North Carolina Institute on Blindness. Judge Brown and Bill are to be two of the speakers. The judge, Bill, and Richard are talking while they wait to be called on the stage. The moderator comes up to them.
Judge Brown and Bill McClure, I'm glad you made it on time. I was getting a little worried.
We just had to get parked. It seems like we're going to have quite a crowd.
And they are the guest speakers, Bob. I don't think they'd start without them.
Oh, you're right. But it is a larger crowd than what we'd expected. That's all the more reason that we have to stay by our schedule. We're just about ready to start.
We're ready. Where do you want us and what do we need to do?
You'll be speaking from right over there. No, over there. Where the microphones are, you don't have to go up yet. Just stay close and I'll come back and get you when we're ready.
Don't worry, I'll take care of it.
Is he always this serious?
That's a kindly way of putting it. He's just supposed to be announcing us. And sometimes he tends to take his position a bit more serious than need be, I think.
Also a nice way of putting it. Do you have any advice for people like that?
Yes, indeed. It's like my father told me many years ago. Whatever you accomplish in life, always remember that you put your pants on one leg at a time, just like everybody else.
Even though I sometimes start out trying to put both legs in the same hole.
Does that happen to you too, Richard? I thought it was just me.
Come on, Bill. You know what I mean.
Yeah, I do.
I don't. What do you mean?
Maybe we went to the same parties?
You sound like some defense attorneys that have appeared in front of me.
Didn't work for them either, did it?
It did break the monotony.
Seriously, though, I remember the story you told when you were first appointed to the bench. You had an interview with former U.S. Senator and Governor Terry Sanford, and as you walked into the door, he asked you what it was like being blind.
I do indeed remember that moment. There were all kinds of nice, irrelevant things I could have said, but there had been a lot of unpleasant things that had been happening to me. I've been struggling with my Behçet's disease, and I was losing my sight, so I just cut to the chase and spoke the truth. What's it like being blind? Well, it sucks.
The first time I heard you say that, I disagreed, but the longer I thought about it, the more I realize that it is true.
It's not easy for a blind man living in a sighted world, is it?
No, it is not. And it's not so much the inability to see that makes it difficult. It's the attitudes that you face. People thinking that just because you may do some things differently than a sighted person, you may not be able to do them at all.
And sometimes they don't even want you to try. But try we must. Every person, sighted or not, absolutely needs a vision. And vision does not have to do so much with eyesight. Vision has more to do with the mind, the thought process, and the imagination. We can flourish in the sighted world. It's not easy, but it can be done.
It made a difference to me when I heard you say that you can't try to live as a sighted person. You have to live as a blind person. I didn't understand that at first either. Then I listened again and heard all of what you said. Live as a blind person, not as a sighted person who happens to be blind. That does make a difference.
We are different, but everyone is different in their own way. Disabled people are not some alien life form. We are just ordinary people that want to be treated with respect.
And given a chance, we can accomplish some pretty extraordinary things.
I was an attorney and a judge for many years, and a good one.
I am a piano tuner and a church organist.
And?
And a pretty good one.
And why?
Because I wouldn't expect any less from myself.
I've often told people that if you can't walk, take a first step. If you can't speak, try your first word. No matter what else, you won't be a failure if you be your best and do your best.
It made a big impact on me when I heard you say, you can't always control your circumstances, but in any circumstance, you can control whether or not you do your best.
Just a couple more minutes now, so nobody go wandering off, please. I don't want to have to come looking for you, okay?
Remember, one leg at a time.
You look a little concerned, Richard. Anything bothering you?
I was just thinking. That time when you and I tried sticking both legs into the same pant leg... Maybe we were the same party.
What?
Remember that night? We got our pants mixed up, and the legs got turned inside out. You couldn't tell the top side from the bottom side, and that's why I tried to stick both legs in the same hole.
Richard, I have no idea what you're talking about. Are you sure you haven't been working around Bob too long?
Gotcha. Actually, I was thinking about something I had read in one of Judge Brown's books.
What was that?
About being a victim. I was going through a rough patch and felt that life was pretty much dumping on me.
Life can do that.
I hadn't done anything to deserve my problems, I thought. It wasn't fair, and I wanted something to be done about it.
I've had a lot of people come into my courtroom with feelings just like that. And what I discovered was that many of them weren't so interested in making things better. They wanted someone to pay for what had happened to them.
Exactly. I was the victim here. Somebody else should be making it up to me.
So what did you do?
In court, you make whatever amends the law allows. But back in life, you have to ask yourself, what next? What was next for you, Richard?
You mean, did I learn from the bad situation, or just tend to keep blaming it for whatever happened next?
Exactly. Did you continue living as a victim, or did you move on again?
That's what you said in your book. Life sucks. Live with it. Move on. Make something of it.
It is very easy to remain the victim. But what happens after the compassion ends? People just get tired of continually hearing you cry for yourself.
I found that out in a hurry. Victims can run out of friends very quickly.
I found out in my own life that if you continue to do the same things over and over and always expect the same result, that's insanity.
For you and for whatever friends you may have left.
It's good to see that you took your own advice.
I didn't always. When I first started losing my sight, I had quite a learning curve to get over. I remember once asking a counselor why he hadn't given me some advice years before. He told me that I hadn't been ready for it. And you know, at that time, I wasn't. I might have heard him, but I wouldn't have listened.
And now?
You want to hear something funny? After all the years, after all the things I've accomplished, after all the things that I've done in adjusting to becoming blind, I am told there are some serious things I have yet to learn in living as a blind person. So they are sending me for a term on the Governor Moorhead campus.
And you're going?
Absolutely, I'm going. How can you give advice to someone else if you can't take it yourself?
Okay, we're ready to start. Up on the stage. Judge, you're first. And Bill, you'll be seated right next to him. I need you in position as I start the introduction.
Bob, have you ever had a problem where you tried to stick both legs into the same pants hole?
Oh, no. Does it show?
No, Bob. You're fine.
And my fly, it's zipped?
I think those are button trousers, Bob.
Oh, yeah. Now, don't confuse me. Let's go.
Gentlemen, if you would each like to take my arm.
What's your talk about tonight, Judge?
Just the kind of things we were talking about while we were waiting. If you want to wait outside, Richard, you may think you have heard it already.
No, it's good to be reminded.
Right. Sometimes it's good for people to hear some things again.
Hopefully not everyone will be hearing them again. Maybe some will be listening for the first time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this meeting of the North Carolina Institute on Blindness. Our first speaker is one of the founders of the Institute. He is a former attorney and a retired judge from Durham County, the Honorable Craig Brown.
And in conclusion, saying that my journey has been somewhat difficult is somewhat of an understatement. But all of us have difficulties and challenges that we need to face, sometimes on a weekly or even a daily basis. I do not consider myself unique. Suffering is universal, and ultimately it affects everyone. I suppose I just got mine up front. And over the years, it has taught me a great deal, both about myself and about others. In spite of this, and because of this, I am deeply grateful to be alive, and I expect to be here a while longer. Celebrate life. Don't take it for granted. Help others. And most of all, don't surrender. Thank you very much.
So ends another episode of Blind. justice.
And now, back to our visit with Judge Brown.
You brought up some programs that you worked in. It seems like you found a little niche as a judge, or at least areas that interested you in working. Would you expand on those just a little bit and give us some more details about the success of some of those programs and how they were able to help?
Well, the TROSA program that I mentioned, just like every human being, every drug addict is not created equal. In the sense that some have a small problem, some have a medium problem, some have a large problem, just depending on the nature and scope of their drug addiction over the years. And sometimes it's not just one drug, it's multiple drugs. There's polysubstance abuse. So what I started with, because I was very interested in that area, because I'd done indigent criminal work since 2 years after I finished law school and represented over 1,000 indigent clients in Durham, and substance abuse was a unifying factor in probably 90% of the cases. And there was very little treatment available to them, particularly those that had large problems, because most of the treatment would be 30 days, maybe 90 days, and that would be the end of it, and there would be very little aftercare thereafter. So that became a real focus, not only before I took the bench, but after it as well. The TROSA program that I described earlier has a 40% success rate for some of the most hardcore drug addicts. And 10 years out, 90% of those 40% are still drug-free. So TROSA is a blessing to Durham with the nature and scope of the drug problem that we have in Durham. And frankly, in many, many communities throughout North Carolina, TROSA takes individuals in through what I call the tough love process, in the sense that a committee of TROSA residents interviews candidates and they determine whether that particular person is genuine in terms of their interest in getting clean or if they're just trying to con a con. Of course, TROSA was not the answer for everybody because not everybody wants to go through a two-year program. The second program that I worked on was Drug Treatment Court. Drug Treatment Court initially was founded in Florida and since spread throughout the United States. And that is a situation where individuals that are charged with offenses are put under more substantial probationary supervision, given greater resources in terms of mental health treatment, housing, sometimes jobs as well. They're followed in court every 2 weeks to determine whether or not they're following through with what they said they would do in terms of combating their drug addiction. And it, too, was a very successful program. It's small, probably about a maximum of 50 people at any given time, but it's been in existence since 1998. I was the first judge in Durham County to be trained as a drug treatment court judge, and I helped set up the program that started in 1999. And it's still there today, even though our Republican legislature completely defunded it 2 years ago.
Now, the difference in these two programs, does TROSA require that the individual has been through some kind of an arrest in a court? They can go straight into the program.
That's correct. Only about half of the TROSA residents are probated, which means they've been convicted.
Okay.
The other half are there voluntarily.
But the other program is dealing with people who have criminal records with drug abuse.
That is correct. And the third program was the creation of the Durham County Criminal Justice Resource Center. This is on the short-term end, in the sense that most of the people that go through the Criminal Justice Resource Center have been convicted of a misdemeanor or low-grade felony in Durham County, and they're required over the term of their probation. Usually it's a 6-month period, a maximum 12-month period, that they're in the program. And they go through, they can receive their GED, they get cognitive behavioral intervention, a substance abuse treatment, job training, things of that nature as well. And it has a success rate of about 40% as well.
Now let's move on to another area of what you've contributed. You have two books that you've written.
I do.
Give me a little bit of information on those. What's the name of the books and what order were they written and what sort of motivated you to write those stories?
Well, the real problem after I stepped down from the bench in May of 2008 was what to do next. Frankly, there was a period of depression after that happened, and it took me a while to get out of that. And at the same time, my second marriage was ending too, and that made it even more difficult. Ultimately, when my youngest daughter came to live with me, after my second wife left, I decided that perhaps my life had been sufficiently interesting to commit to paper at the tender age of 52. I had started both books, or the contents of both books, about 15 years before. My life story was sufficiently interesting, at least to me, may not be to anybody else, but at least to me, to commit to paper, if not just for my family, maybe for somebody else I could help too. Blind Justice, which is my legal autobiography, was written in 2009, and my second book, A Fork in the Road, A Story of Chronic Illness, Fortitude, Faith in Our Nation, was completed last year. I did the second book myself, with the help of many other individuals too, of course, and frankly, I consider it, because it's been well edited and well proofed, to be a better reflection of the quality that I'd like to have.
Now, just give you a little plug here. Where can people find those books if they are able to just buy a regular hard copy book?
Well, you can purchase the book off Amazon.com. Simply go to AforkInTheRoad.com/Craig Brown. It'll take you right to the book page. The first book is not available. It's out of print, but I have a bunch of copies at my home, and you can still purchase that book through me. Simply hit judge.craig.brown@gmail.com, and you can get to my web address and go from there. In terms of where they're available, they're primarily available in Durham and Chapel Hill, through the Regulator Bookshop on 9th Street in Durham, through the Flyleaf Books on Martin Luther King Boulevard in Chapel Hill, as well as UNC student stores. It's also available on Kindle through Amazon.com. Both of my books, both Blind Justice and A Fork in the Road, will be available through the North Carolina Library for the Blind and the Disabled. What I'm hoping, as a result of a last burst of publicity, is that a publisher will find me and will become more widely available throughout the state. But that's preliminary right now.
One of the volunteers at Triangle Radio Reading Service has been reading one of the books so that we can share that with our listeners, hopefully in the near future.
Yeah, I'm excited by that. I look forward to listening to it and, frankly, to see how he's edited my edited book.
You can judge on that when you hear it.
I look forward to it, though. I really do, and I appreciate the time and effort that he's put into it.
Well, it sounds like your story's got a lot more than what we're able to cover in the program that we're talking here, and I think a lot of our listeners probably like to find out a little more about how you've been able to accomplish all that you've done. Craig, you've talked about how you lost your sight due to some health issue. It sounds like there are some other complications as well. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about that?
I have no problem talking about it. My underlying illness is called Behçet's syndrome or Behçet's disease. It is a very rare autoimmune disease. There are about 13,000 cases in the United States, which works out to a couple hundred people per state. It is a disease that causes small blood vessels to erupt. It would start with mouth ulcers, any soft membrane in the body, skin ulcers, arthritis, and ultimately led to uveitis, conjunctivitis, retinitis, optic nerve atrophy, and most recently, and this has been troubling to me because it usually doesn't happen on the back end, it happens on the front end, it has gone neurological, which means it's gone to my brain. I had a small stroke in 2001. And a very much more substantial stroke in 2006, and from which I've never fully recovered. And I don't like that. Initially, with Behçet's, I was always able to come back to baseline after a particular attack, and I was able to do that for the better share of 20 years. The fact that that hasn't happened now is troubling to me, but you make the best of it. That's all you can do. And that's what I intend to do. Now, there's some indication that Behçet's, when it hits the brain, is ultimately fatal. Well, I'm 55. I'm going to die of something. So in the meantime, he's going to have to find me.
Let's move on to the present and looking forward. Where are you right now in your life and what's coming up?
Well, I got married a year and a half ago. My wife, Jan, is a 12-year survivor of ovarian cancer, which is very rare to be a survivor of that particular type of cancer. So we have an understanding, I think, just on the basis of that. Certainly, I know that I've been doing better since I met her. There's no doubt about that. Right now, I am at the rehab center here in Raleigh to learn additional skills to help me. I'm going back to work full time.
Now, you've also started a new foundation?
Well, I've started a new nonprofit.
Okay.
That is the North Carolina Institute on Blindness. My partners in crime are Steve Murphy, who now presently works as district manager for the Division of Services for the Blind, but is close to retirement, as well as Nat Fullwood, who used to be the director of the rehab center. So between the three of us, we have 120 years of blindness.
So new job, new wife, new endeavors on a nonprofit. Sounds Absolutely. Like you're still keeping very busy.
Rock and roll.
One of the things I'd like to ask, we have listeners all ages, all different degrees of vision impairment, some of them print impaired. Give them your pep talk. What would you like to say to them?
What I'd like to say in a paragraph or two is simply never give up and never lie down. I mean, life is going to throw a curveball at you, whether it's going to be loss of your sight, whether it's going to be loss of a limb, whether it's going to be cancer, heart disease, whatever it may be. Life is not out there to be pretty, and you have to be prepared for it. And if it happens, you have to deal with it. And that means you have to do the work to make the best of your situation, which means that you have to realize that you have to change. And that's the hardest thing for a lot of people, particularly as they get older. You have to want to change to meet the difficulties of your situation going forward, because that will make you a better person in the long run. I mean, I will be going to the Adjustment to Blindness course this fall. I've been blind for 20 years. Why am I doing that? I tell you what, it'll make the next 20 years better.
Craig Brown, thank you very much for sharing so many personal things with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
See, I told you something interesting was going to happen. I wonder if Dr. Bill was listening. Let's ask.
It's time for Insights with Dr. Bill.
This is Dr. Bill. What's on your mind?
Dr. Bill, were you listening to the interview with Judge Craig Brown?
Yes, I was. And before we go any further, are you sure you're all right with three blind people on the show with you at the same time?
Three? Oh, you mean, well, you must have misheard me when I misspoke earlier. I'm not bothered at all. But remember, I don't have three arms.
Very interesting.
Now, what's on your mind?
We had a very interesting talk with Craig Brown today. He's a former Lawyer of the Year and District Court Judge from Durham County.
I know.
And he has been able to accomplish all these things in his life, even though that he is
completely blind. I know.
You knew all that? Gee, Dr. Bill, you are good.
And as someone who is also blind, one of the most interesting things about him is his willingness to be so candid about his personal life.
Dr. Bill's right. People sometimes are shy about telling someone else about the not-so-happy parts of their lives. And that may be all right if all you're interested in is your own self-image.
But if you feel that you have something or have experienced things that can help someone else find a better and more fulfilling life, you have got to be willing to share your deepest feelings and failings, or your accomplishments will seem out of reach.
And Craig Brown has certainly done that.
One thing I'd like to add. Judge Brown mentioned that one of our volunteers was reading his book, A Fork in the Road, for TRRS. That complete recording has been broadcast and is available for re-listening through our audio on-demand feature listed under podcasts on the TRRS website. The reading is also being processed by the State Library for the Blind. His other book, Blind Justice, is in process.
And also, besides the location Judge Brown mentioned, his two books are available through used booksellers like Barnes & Noble and Alibris.
I'm sure glad we had him on our program.
Interesting enough for you, Bob?
Oh, it sure was.
This has been Dr. Bill, and thanks for telling me what's on your mind.
And so ends another episode of Insights with Dr. Bill. Conversations. The voices of TRRS.
Our guest today is Al Reynolds.
I'm Al Reynolds, and I read the Triangle Business Journal for the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
Tell us about your background.
I'm a North Carolina native, born and raised in Winston-Salem. I married a Raleigh native, which is why I'm here. Currently, I work at the United Way of the Greater Triangle in a direct service program called Teaming for Technology. We refurbish computers for nonprofits and schools and individuals that need them, which include blind people.
What is your special area of interest relating to TRRS?
I got cornered by Linda Orrant, who said, "You've got a great voice. Come read for us." I've had nothing but fun since I've been here.
Good. How long have you been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service?
Not quite a year.
How did you choose TRRS as your organization with which to volunteer?
It comes from having the talent of speaking well, and Triangle Radio Reading Service is a partner agency at United Way of the Greater Triangle. Since I refurbish computers, TRRS is a recipient of some of the computers that I've built. So the technology that I build is used here at the studio.
What do you hope to accomplish as a TRRS volunteer?
I do know that I've got a voice, I have a talent, and it can be used by people who don't have something, which is sight.
Has anything particularly interesting happened to you as a volunteer?
As a matter of fact, it has. My very first time in the studio, I was promised that I would just observe, reading the Saturday morning news. The second person didn't show up, so I had to go on live for the very first time. Actually, I was set up. This was part of my training to see how I'd react. Felt like I'd just come off a roller coaster ride when it was done, and honestly, reading 70 obituaries straight through was something of a strain. It made me kind of nervous, so I went to the recording side of the studio, recording the Triangle Business Journal.
Is there any other thing that you would like to add to our interview today?
One of the most amazing things of my job at Teaming for Technology is to help load software on a computer to be used by a gentleman who is blind. It's called JAWS, and it speaks to him. He does not need a monitor, but I did when I loaded the software. And I had been in this program for 2.5 years, and I was amazed to watch a blind man use a computer. He listens to the speakers. He can change the pitch and the frequency, and he uses a computer as well as I do. Interestingly, he does not use a mouse, because a mouse is an optical instrument. He is strictly a keyboard user.
I'm glad you pointed that out. I, too, am a JAWS user. Tell us again the name of your program and when it airs.
I record the Triangle Business Journal, and it airs on Saturdays at 1 o'clock, 1 p.m.
Well, thank you, Al, for being our guest today on the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
Thank you, Bill.
Since this has been such an interesting program, how about a visit from Professor Bill?
It's time now for Outside the Box with Professor Bill. The problem. There was once a very wise king who had two sons. He wanted to be sure the wiser of the two would succeed him on the throne. So he set up a test and told his sons to meet him the next day out in the fields. On the following day, the young princes arrived on their respective horses, tied them up, and approached their father. Then he laid out the plan. There was to be a horse race from where they were standing to the village church and return. The owner of the losing horse would become the next king. Immediately, one of the princes, let's call him Bill, raced over, jumped up on the horse, and took off towards the village. The other prince, let's call him...
Don't say it!
Monkey's uncle just stood and watched, totally bewildered. Who would become the next king?
Well, this one is obvious. Monkey's uncle.
Are you sure of this?
Well, obviously. Bill didn't listen and thought he was supposed to win the race, and so took off.
What if he heard correctly and found a sure way to lose the race and become the king?
Well, that could only happen if he didn't go to the village. Ooh, wait a minute. Not a bad idea. He goes off first and then wanders off into the forest and waits for the other brother to pass by.
The other brother could do the same thing.
At least one of the brothers has to finish the race, or the king isn't going to allow either of them to succeed him.
Well, then Bill goes down to the village and starts back and waits until his brother starts. Then he comes back and moves the starting line, and then just stands there as if he had one. The other brother gets fooled.
I think the king wanted his successor to be smart, not a cheater. So?
Well, I guess Bill just didn't understand the instructions, and so isn't very smart.
Remember the problem. Who becomes the next king?
Well, the prince who loses the race.
No, the prince who owns the losing horse wins.
Oh, so it doesn't make any difference which prince wins or loses, only whose horse loses.
That's right.
So, Bill jumps on his brother's horse and wins the race.
But his horse loses, and Bill becomes the next king.
Well, I'll be a...
Another solution, thanks to creative thinking from... Outside the Box.
Before we go, here are some real-life events from American courtrooms.
Could you see him from where you were standing?
I could see his head.
And where was his head?
Just above his shoulders.
Do you drink on duty?
I don't drink when I'm on duty, unless I come on duty drunk.
You say you're innocent, yet five people swore they saw you steal a watch.
I can produce 500 people who didn't see me steal it.
I understand that you are Dean Roberts' father.
That's right.
And how long have you known him?
What is your relationship with the plaintiff?
She's my daughter.
Was she your daughter on February 13th, 1979?
How long have you been a French Canadian?
This is Bill McClure for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and thanks for listening in to this edition of Take My Arm.
This is Richard Dunnigan. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is prepared with the assistance of print and visually impaired volunteers.
And this is Bob Martin. We would like to thank the North Carolina Institute on Blindness and the State Library for the Blind in assisting the work of the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and we look forward to further efforts of cooperation in serving the print and visually impaired of the Triangle area.
If you might be able to help underwrite the special programming of the Triangle Radio Reading Service, please call us at 919-832-5138.
It is your assistance that helps keep us on the air. Thank you.
Until next time,
goodbye.